Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host Tim Henney. Well, today in the program, we're going to rebroadcast an interview that we've been getting quite a few comments about. It's an interview with Dr. Terry Walls. She suffers from her own multiple sclerosis, and she has revolutionized the treatment with principles behind diet and a new protocol that she has developed to fight her own MS. She, to a certain extent, has cured some of the debilitating effects of the disease.
I'm Tim Henney. Good morning, Lynn. And then a conversation with physical therapist Adele Levine. She specializes in the rehab of amputee victims, and she's written Run, Don't Walk, her story of treating veterans at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. She calls the experience curious and chaotic. We'll find out why.
All right. This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. We'll be right back after this. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Catherine Simos, president of Grand Valley Bank, Frontier Branch in Park City, a proud supporter of KPCW. Our team can help you with all of your banking needs, from deposit accounts to business lending. We have one branch in Park City and two branches in Heber and Midway, Heber Valley Bank. GrandValleyBank.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
KPCW's new classified ads are now on Facebook. Join the Facebook group KPCW Classifieds in Ryborg and see what's being sold, hired, rented, and searched for today. Post what you're getting rid of or what you're looking for free. Another service for locals, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Experience the ride of a lifetime on the Comet Bobsled Ride and Rocket Skeleton Ride at the Utah Olympic Park. Take a thrilling ride down the entire length of the 2002 Olympic track, ripping through 15 turns and reaching speeds up to 80 miles per hour on the Winter Comet Bobsled Ride. The Rocket Skeleton Ride offers the solo adventure of shooting headfirst down the last five turns of the track. Reservations required. Details and restrictions are available online at UtahOlympicLegacy.com. Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing sport and recreation opportunities.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. Well, like many physicians, Dr. Terry Walls focused on treating her patients' ailments with drugs or surgical procedures until she was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis back in 2000. Within 3 years, her back and stomach muscles had weakened to the point where she needed a tilt-recline wheelchair. Conventional medical treatments were failing her, and she feared that she would be bedridden for the rest of her life. Now, determined to change her dismal prognosis, Dr. Walls began studying the latest research on autoimmune disease and brain biology. She embraced the concepts of functional medicine. She has written a book called The Walls Protocol, How I Beat Progressive MS Using Paleo Principles and Functional Medicine. Not only is this book interesting for those with MS, it's interesting as a her concept on health and diet overall is very interesting to anyone. We interviewed Dr. Terry Walls last month. We've been getting a lot of comments about that interview, so we're going to go ahead and rebroadcast that. This is Dr. Terry Walls. Well, Dr. Terry Walls' story of multiple sclerosis is no different than most. The years of clues and strange symptoms that finally, in retrospect, make sense. Once she was diagnosed, the doctor in her was compelled to find answers, a diagnosis, and a cure. But the patient in her was compelled to save her own life. As conventional medicine continued to fail her, the patient won, and she began to experiment on herself. What she discovered saved and completely changed her life. Since then, she's changed countless other lives as well. Dr. Terry Walls is the author of The Walls Protocol, How I Beat Progressive MS Using Paleo Principles and Functional Medicine. Dr. Terry Walls is joining us by phone. Good morning to you and welcome to The Mountain Life.
Good morning. Very glad to be here.
Well, it's nice to have you. And it's interesting to me, first of all, I just want to say, I don't know how it varies from community to community or state to state, but I know so many people with MS and who are recently diagnosed with MS. What kind of statistics are there?
So So traditionally we say there's about 400,000 people in the U.S. with MS. When you're diagnosed, 80% are diagnosed with relapsing remitting. When you get worse, that's called a relapse. When you get better, that's called a remission. Those will progress on to secondary progressive, where there's no longer any improvement, only steady decline. 10% are diagnosed with primary progressive and never have any improvement. They just go through a steady decline.
Pretty big numbers. And I know that it all types of MS, depending on, well, not all types, but depending upon where the lesions are on your brain, it's very different for many different people. And that's why it must be difficult to come up with a protocol, which you have, Dr. Walls. And maybe just start with your own diagnosis and take us through what the symptoms were and how debilitating it was.
I was diagnosed in 2000 because I had some foot drop and weakness in my left leg. I had an MRI in my brain and spinal cord and many, many other tests over several weeks. Then I had a spinal tap. I had lesions on my neck, abnormal spinal fluid. And when they looked at my medical record, they saw that I had had problems of visual dimming 13 years earlier. I was told to take disease-modifying drugs. I went and got a second opinion from the internationally recognized Cleveland Clinic, and they said, yes, you have MS. You should take disease-modifying drugs. And so I began that. By 2003, my disease had transitioned to the progressive phase of the disease, where you get no more improvements, and it's called secondary progressive MS. I took mitoxantrone, a form of chemotherapy. It had a lot of side effects. Then I took Tysabri, another more potent immune suppressant that cost about $40,000 a year, but that was pulled from the market, and then I switched to Celcept. And so in 2007, at my nadir, I was so weak I could sit up for maybe 10, 15 minutes in a standard chair. Otherwise, I had to be in a recliner or in bed because my torso muscles were that weak.
So, Dr. Walls, you found yourself in this condition, and that led you away from traditional medicine because you were still declining. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. So when I hit the wheelchair, that's when I decided to go back to reading the medical science myself. And I started reading the animal studies for mouse models of multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's dementia, Huntington's disease. And I saw that mitochondria were not working well in all of those diseases. So then I searched for papers about how to help the mitochondria. And I started adding vitamins and supplements to my regimen, and that slowed the speed of my decline. I was very, very grateful. But I was still declining. And so at 2007, I created this protocol in an effort to stop the decline. I had accepted that there'd never be any recovery. And so I was quite, my physicians were stunned, my family was stunned, and so was I, and it really felt quite miraculous, the level of improvement that happened and how quickly everything began to come back.
That's an amazing thing that everybody was surprised in what you were able to come to. But what also surprises me about what you just said is that it seems like all this research and data was out there that pointed you in the direction of the mitochondria with the mouse studies, and yet it hadn't been really compiled and brought into mainstream medicine in any way. Am I mishearing you on that?
Absolutely true. Studies in mice, the knowledge you get there usually takes about 50 years to get into a clinical practice. And so my decision to read the mouse studies was that I wanted to see what people were going to be doing in 30 to 50 years. And that's where I thought my best hope lied.
And is that something that, as a physician, you're able to do? I mean, you had the background and the knowledge, and you knew that what the procedure was and the process and the protocol for bringing something into mainstream, and you were able to sort of leapfrog that using yourself as the case study.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's important for people to realize I had accepted that there was no recovery. So I did everything that I did hoping to just stay flat. But of course, everyone, we now know that. I didn't stay flat. I had this dramatic recovery. Yeah, and it really changed how I see disease and how it changed the clinical practice that I do, and it changed the focus of my clinical research.
So where are you now in terms of your health, what you can perform? You say you're no longer in decline, but what symptoms are lingering?
I continue to steadily improve. I can bike comfortably. I go biking with my family. I'm walking on a treadmill. Just last week I did my 20-minute walk. I'm at 3.5 miles an hour for the first 10 minutes, 4 miles an hour for the second 10 minutes, and then I'm alternating between walking and jogging. That's how much improved I've made. I still can't jog for 20 minutes, but now I begin to see that, I think that will likely be achievable.
And so this is 14 years after you were first diagnosed. Is that right?
Correct.
Dr. Walls, let's talk about the role of mitochondria. And for those of us who have forgotten from Biology 101, what mitochondria is and the importance of cellular health. Can you take us through a quick lesson on that?
So we're all alive because of chemistry. When the chemistry stops, we're dead. When the chemistry happens incorrectly, molecules get made with the wrong shape, and ultimately that will lead to sick cells, sick organs, sick humans. Mitochondria are how our cells generate and process energy. In the really ancient bacteria that got into our ancestors 1.5 billion years ago, our brain, our retina, and our heart have the most mitochondria per cell. And clinically, if you're suffering from fatigue, brain fog, or declining endurance because you have less effective heart pumping, that's a terrific indication that your mitochondria are likely starved, not working very well, and would do well to get a big Walls tune-up.
So how do we feed our mitochondria?
So my protocol really is designed to improve the health of the mitochondria and the health of the cell. So and here's the big picture on the diet. It's 9 cups of fruits and vegetables divided between leafy greens, sulfur-rich vegetables in the cabbage, onion, mushroom family, and deeply colored things like peppers, tomatoes, beets, berries, high-quality protein, animal meats, organ meats, and seaweed. Exclude foods that are likely causing worsening inflammation and are probably relatively toxic to the cells. And that would be the gluten grains, dairy proteins, and egg. I have a longer conversation about why to exclude them in the book.
Now, it's interesting. We talk so much on the show about anti-inflammatory diets and things like that. A lot of times, red meat is counted as inflammatory. So what's your argument on that?
For 2.5 million years, our ancestors were eating meat. I don't think meat is the problem, although I do have a conversation about factory-farmed meat that has more toxins in it and will be less health-promoting. The real inflammatory problem is a high sugar white flour, a high glycemic load diet. That is extremely inflammatory, extremely damaging.
And so along with this, with the paleo principles, there's also some discussion. Some of the diets include grains and others don't.
So I've made 3 diets, the Walls diet, the Walls paleo, and then the more advanced, the Walls paleo plus, which is a ketogenic diet. At the Walls diet, people can have non-gluten grains, but they can't. I limit that to just 1 serving a day. When they go to the Walls paleo, it stresses more animal proteins, organ meats, seaweeds, fermented foods, and restricts the legumes and grains to just 2 servings a week. And then in the paleo plus, we're reducing carbohydrates further, increasing fat, and we're shifting the fuel that we burn from carbohydrate-based to fat-based while putting people in ketosis. And I have a long conversation about how ketones are terrific fuel for the brain and initiate a lot of healing in the brain. So it's a terrific protocol for those particularly worried about their brain.
Interesting. If you're just joining us, our guest is Dr. Terry Walls. She's the author of The Walls Protocol, How I Beat Progressive MS Using Paleo Principles and Functional Medicine. I just want to point out on the back cover of your book, Dr. Walls, there are two photos of you. One, you're in a wheelchair, and the next, you're straddling your bicycle, looking very happy.
And there's just 1 year difference between those two.
Wow.
And Dr. Walls, I know in the book you talk extensively about getting the nutrients for the mitochondria and all the various proteins and enzymes that are part of the chemistry of the body through whole foods. But and you don't you tried supplements and you found that helped, but it wasn't really where you wanted to be. But let's say for somebody who wants a start, isn't a supplement vitamin program that has things like, Q10 in it and some of these really critical elements, a good starting point? I mean, wouldn't it create a foundation for somebody to begin or lay the foundation?
The research that comes in really shows us that if you don't change the diet, supplements themselves tend to be not very helpful. In most of the studies that have looked at adding a particular vitamin, have found it really doesn't change the desired health outcomes. And sometimes it makes things worse. And that really is because our nutrition has to do with ratios between the vitamins, the minerals, and the various nutrients. And so if we get our nutrients from food with very thoughtful supplementation that's going to be monitored, that's where the magic happens. If you don't change your diet, you just add supplements, do not expect a big change.
Well, that's a little bit disappointing for those of us who take vitamins. I've always felt that my vitamin protocol really helped.
Vitamins are helpful when you've really changed your diet and you've ramped up your nutrition. But for much of the public, they think, I'll just take some vitamins, I'll keep eating a high sugar, high carbohydrate-based diet. They will not see much benefit.
I see. So they're using it as the cure, and it's not. It's just part of a process, which is a much bigger picture of the totality of the diet and things of that nature.
Yes. You know, supplements, in a very thoughtful way, can be helpful as an addition. But instead, doing the supplements instead of changing your diet will be a very minimal benefit.
I see. Now, there's something else I wanted to ask you about. A common theme that we have on the show is we talk about smoothies, and I know that you pointed out smoothies as a positive thing, and I use a smoothie every morning, and I was thrilled to hear about this, but I feel that I lay the foundation with my spinach smoothie. I know you're a big proponent of kale, but it's kind of along the same lines. A lot of fruit, a lot of green leafy vegetables in this smoothie, a lot of fiber. It doesn't get ground up that much. And I feel that, as you point out, it starts the day and lays a very important foundation, and then you can layer on other sorts of foods on top of that.
It's a terrific way to start the day, and I've been doing that now since 2008. I have a smoothie in the morning, often with greens, and I like to rotate the greens. As fond as I am of kale, I don't have kale every day, so I'll have kale, spinach, and then I'll have dandelion greens. So I rotate my food so I don't have the same food. But a big smoothie in the morning, a source of protein, usually leftover meat from the night before, and that's my morning.
And in your smoothie, you talk about three heaping plates of leafy greens a day. How much of that portion of your three plates do you get into your smoothie, just out of curiosity?
So it's three plates of vegetables overall for the day, and I probably get one plate full's worth of vegetables and berries in my morning smoothie.
Plus,
I would say 3 to 4 ounces of meat, and that's my very typical breakfast.
That's an amazing thing, thinking about trying to get three plates of vegetables, one of them occurring in the smoothie, because now that I'm doing the smoothie every day, which I've done for a year straight now, I have to say, and it's been quite amazing, it made me – one of the things it made me realize was how little vegetable and fruit I ate when I thought I was a vegetable and fruit consumer. And it turns out once you start buying it for your smoothie every day – I realized I was not. And then to think that I'm only purchasing one third of what I would need, that's really kind of shocking.
You know, in our clinical trial, people keep food diaries, so we know what they're eating, and then we have them chart how well they're hitting the targets for our various food groups. That really helps them change their dietary habits and be successful with implementing the WALS protocol. In my clinical practice, again, we talk about food diaries and recording how you're doing and hitting the targeted food groups. It's very helpful when people are changing their eating plans to do something like that.
Dr. Walls, wanted to head back in to talk about meat. We're starting to hear that saturated fats may not be as bad as we have been hearing all of these decades.
Sure.
What's your take on that?
So all of our cells are wrapped in a cell membrane. And there's a very specific ratio of saturated fat, cholesterol, omega-3 fat, and omega-6 fat in that cell membrane. And so to be have healthy cells, we have to have healthy cell membranes, which means we do need to have saturated fat, cholesterol, and the omega-3 and omega-6 fats in our diet. When we don't, that damages our cells. So I couldn't agree more. We need animal proteins, we need saturated fats for the optimal health of our cell membrane, which means we need it for the optimal health of our cells if we want our chemistry in our cells and body to be functioning well.
Huh, that's very interesting. Dr. Walls, before we let you go, no doubt now this is your specialization, but before you got into all of this, what was your specialization in medicine?
So I'm an internal medicine doc at an academic center, so we're teaching residents and taking care of things like diabetes, heart disease, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, mental health issues. And I used to think that you use the latest, newest drugs and the latest surgical procedures and all this complementary alternative medicine, integrative medicine, you know, was sort of a waste of time and a waste of money. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, I've changed my thinking on all of that, and I realize that the keys to health lie in diet and lifestyle choices.
That's right. Well, Dr. Terry Walls, we thank you so much for joining us today. Again, the book is The Walls Protocol. There's also a great TED Talk that you give that kind of sums this all up. And then do you have a website?
Yes, Terry, T-E-R-R-Y, Walls, W-A-H-L-S.com. Your listeners should go there and download the free materials that we talked about in the book. And we have lots of videos, including the TED Talk video, to help people get started.
Sounds great. Dr. Walls, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Again, that was Dr. Terry Walls in a previously recorded interview that we broadcast last month. We got lots of comments about it, so we thought we'd rebroadcast it today. Very interesting. Stay with us. This is The Mountain Life, only in Park City, only on KPCW. We'll be right back.
The Glittertind at Stein Erickson Lodge is a proud supporter of KPCW. The Glittertind restaurant offers regional American cuisine with Chef Zane Holmquist seasonal menus. Located mid-mountain at Deer Valley Resort, the Glittertind serves breakfast, lunch, and dinner daily. Sunday brunch with live music. Reservations recommended. 645-6455.
Hi, I'm Dr. Lisa Saturnino, and I'm excited to announce that the Intermountain Park City Bonanza Clinic will now be a full-time InstaCare. For your ongoing medical needs, you'll see our partners at the Intermountain Park City Clinic at Round Valley. For your fractures, lacerations, and urgent care needs, come by and see us at the Bonanza InstaCare. 7 days a week, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit organization.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. Well, we just spoke with Dr. Terry Walls with the Walls Protocol. And in just a few minutes, we'll be speaking with Adele Levine. She has written a book recently on rehabbing amputees at one of the largest centers for amputee rehab in the country in Washington, D.C., at the Walter Reed Army Medical Center. And in the meantime, it turns out that Tim over there across the table has found a little an interesting article about aging skin and how you can stop the aging process. We're interested in this.
And,
I am.
I ran across it in the New York Times wellness blog from one of our favorite interviewees, who is Gretchen Reynolds, and we've had her on the show a couple of times. So Gretchen wrote this article that has to do with new studies and research that has found that you can arrest and even reverse the process of skin aging through exercise, which is quite amazing. And there are two layers of skin that through the aging process, there's the outer layer that thickens and an inner layer that thins. And through gathering a bunch of volunteers and checking their skin below their short line, so where the sun doesn't shine on skin, they found with the sedentary group of data that their skin aligned just exactly with what they would have expected over time. The skin thickened on the outer layer and became thinner on the inner layer. But with the group, the control group that exercised with the same age profile, they saw something clearly different, which was that the skin aligned with much younger people in their 20s and 30s. So then they took the sedentary group and they exercised them for a period of time, and they found that their skin over a three-month period of a 30-minute exercise at a high aerobic capacity actually arrested and reversed the process of aging, and the outer layer thinned and the inner layer thickened, which is what you find in younger people. So they saw something very surprising. It's preliminary. It's not a big study at this point, but there's strong evidence to suggest that exercise, aside from all the other various factors, diet and exposure to sun and all those kinds of things does actually reverse aging of the skin. But then they also point out that when you go outside and exercise, you're getting sun exposure, which is an aging agent.
Yeah, in a big way. And it would be interesting to note that probably none of their control group lives at 7,000 feet. That's another factor. But it is interesting and heartening to know that a little exercise, well, it's good for you in a variety of ways.
And they link the whole thing to these myokines, which is something that's an enzyme or a protein that is kicked off through exercise and goes and activates different processes in cells throughout the body. And that's what they think is they found 50% more of these myokines in people who exercise than sedentary people.
Good stuff, that Gretchen Reynolds. She always brings wonderful articles. She condenses and sort of coalesces the science and makes it readable in her New York Times blog, and she always has some very interesting topics. Well, let's go ahead and welcome our next guest. In her 6 years at Walter Reed Army Medical Center, Adele Levine rehabilitated soldiers admitted in progressively worse and worse shape as body armor and advanced trauma care helped save lives, if not the limbs, of American soldiers fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq. Walter Reed Medical Center quickly became the world leader in amputee rehabilitation. Adele and her colleagues treated the highest concentration of multi-limb amputees in the world, up to 150 patients a day. And now our next guest has written a book. It's called Run, Don't Walk, and it's about being at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. It's what one critic called MASH meets Scrubs. I like that. It's a sharply observant, darkly funny, but totally unique memoir of sorts. And Adele Levine is joining us now by phone. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Well, so far, Tim and I have already had an argument this morning about what is the correct pronunciation of the last name, Levine.
Well, I pronounce it Levine, but I've heard both ways.
Okay. It's not if you came from...
Those years.
Okay. So if your ancestors came from one country versus another, it's just up to personal preference.
I would think so.
Okay. So we'll go with Levine. Well, thanks for joining us on The Mountain Life, Adele. And first of all, let's talk a little bit about the Walter Reed Army Medical Center. It's in Washington, D.C. I've read that there's something like 5,500 rooms. It's a huge place. And why would you end up there?
You would end up there if you're an active duty soldier or a dependent who needed medical care. You were in that area. But as we got into these wars, we stopped seeing routine medical patients, and we started just dedicating ourselves to combat care. Pretty much all the orthopedic injuries that happened at Afghanistan or Iraq passed through Walter Reed Army Medical Center. The ones that required extensive rehabilitation would stay at Walter Reed, and the others would be kind of patched up and sent to their home units to be treated closer to home.
Okay, so after an injury happens when you're overseas fighting a war, how quickly would you see some of these patients? I mean, have they dealt with, in the case of an amputee, have they already dealt somewhat with the psychological aspects of being an amputee?
No, not at all.
Okay.
In fact, a lot of them woke up at Walter Reed, and one of the things that you would witness was, medical providers going into a patient's room and, you know, telling them, do you know you're okay? Do you know where you are? You know, you're at Walter Reed. You know, you're at Walter Reed and you're okay. Because a lot of them, you know, they were just as surprised to find themselves there. We saw many of our patients within 72 hours of their injury. They were quickly airlifted out of theater to a combat support hospital, and then placed on a kind of flying surgical plane. Would bring them to Longstuhl in Germany, and then from there they would take off again and head toward Walter Reed. On their way, as they were in the air, they would already email Walter Reed, and we would have operating rooms available for all the patients. As soon as they landed, they would be brought right into the ORs.
And Adele, what's happened to Walter Reed? Didn't it go through a transformation in 2011 and the facility moved, one shut down and something else opened?
Yeah. Unfortunately, you know, the old Walter Reed Army Medical Center was closed due to kind of congressional budget cuts in 2011. And we were merged with the Bethesda Naval Hospital down the road. You know, which I have to say was devastating for the staff and also, I say, the patients at Walter Reed, that we were kind of shut down, you know, during our finest hour.
And how has that affected, I mean, you just said that was devastating. So can we explore that devastation just a little bit? I mean,
what
was the consequence of closing Walter Reed? And then, I mean, I guess, I assume you're still treating veterans who are being flown into some facility.
Yes. I mean, well, the new Walter Reed definitely has a different feel to it. You know, the old Walter Reed had a long, long history. It was the oldest Army hospital in America. It treated soldiers for over 102 years from every major war, from World War I forward. And, you know, we were kind of its last chapter, sort of a strange way. You know, when they made the decision to close Walter Reed, you know, that happened in 2005, and you know, things were busy, but they weren't nearly as busy as they began to be. Because remember, when we went into these wars, you know, we thought it would be over in a couple weeks. By the time that we closed, our caseload had tripled, and we were just really, you know, running over there. But again, we had a system. We had a system that worked. We knew what we were doing, and I felt like, now, I can't speak for everyone, but that it sort of slowed things down to move us to a new facility. But luckily, by the time we got to the new facility, things had changed quite a bit on the ground, and we weren't seeing so many injuries. And, you know, I left maybe a few months ago, and one of the reasons I left was because we just weren't seeing any patients. You know, our caseload had dropped dramatically. We had hardly any patients, which was a really good thing.
Yeah.
But Adele, does that mean that you left because there was staff reduction and you were, you know, part of that staff reduction? Or did you leave because you have become acclimated to a certain pace and rhythm of activity in your profession? And how are you, if that's the case, where are you going to find that?
Oh, I'm never going to find that again. I mean, I felt like I had to leave while I was still having a good time. I didn't want to be sort of hanging around there and just, you know, reminiscing about what it used to be like. And, you know, I just, there was staff reduction, but it wasn't like a forcible reduction. It was just they were moving people around. And it just, it wasn't the same anymore. And I felt like I needed to kind of take charge of my career and move on, you know. And I tried to find a place kind of like Walter Reed with a big staff, but you just can't find that. So I ended up working with a friend of mine, and we do kind of like home health where we go into patients' houses, and I'm working mostly with older people. So it's different, but, you know, I will never be able to replicate what it was like to be at Walter Reed.
Right. Good thing you became a writer.
Yeah.
And, you know, your book, I have to say, every review that I have read of it, I mean, people say things like this book should be required reading for all Americans. And I think that it's the way that you there's so much love conveyed in the book that you have for these patients, and that there is just passed around Walter Reed in general. There's emotion. It can be funny, even though it's such a difficult subject. So if you wouldn't mind talking about how difficult it is to be there and how ill or well-equipped you were as a physical therapist to deal with, you know, the psychology of losing limbs.
Well, I have to say I was completely unprepared for what I was getting myself into. You know, I kind of optimistically applied for a job at Walter Reed just because I lived across the street. So I thought, you know, oh, you know, easy commute, easy job. And
on your bike?
Yeah. Well, I moved later, but I continued to ride my bike. But I was completely blown away from what I saw in there. And I wasn't really prepared. You know, and in physical therapy school, we don't take classes in psychology or motivation. You know, that would have been very helpful for me to learn how to help people in those situations. But I was lucky because I stepped into a place where there was a lot of camaraderie and a lot of teamwork, and we were all kind of in it together. And so there was a tremendous amount of support. You know, we were all part of something that was much larger than ourselves, and I think everybody in the hospital felt that way. And I'm not just talking about the medical staff, but, you know, the patients, their families, the cafeteria workers, you know, the security guards. I mean, everybody felt like they were working on something that was really important.
Well, I can imagine for someone who's just recently become an amputee, having this, feeling like the medical center and everyone there is like this big security blanket, and then not really wanting to leave because then you're just out and this is your new life. But, you know, was it like that at all?
Oh, totally. Totally. And we used to sometimes accuse patients of becoming institutionalized. But you know who got really institutionalized was the staff. I mean, I certainly was. You know, I thought, oh, my God, you know, I'm going to be eating defect chicken for the rest of my life. You know, like, this is it. You know, last stop, Walter Reed. And that was part of the reason why I felt like I needed to leave, too.
Wow. So, Adele, what happens currently with veterans, with somebody who has experienced a severe injury or amputation and they're flown into the new Walter Reed? Are they getting the care that we have been told that we want to give them as a nation? Or has that changed?
Oh, they're getting fantastic care. You know, and again, keep in mind, you know, I worked in the amputee section. If you are an amputee, get down on your knees and pray you can go to Walter Reed. I mean, there is no better place in the world. We are the world's largest and most experienced amputee center. you know, and we have access to the latest and greatest in prosthetic technology, but we also know how to get you on your feet and keep you in mind that, you know, most of our patients aren't single leg amputees, and most of them are missing both of their legs. And most of them have very high amputations, you know, above the knee, at the hip, even part of their pelvis. If you want to walk again with that kind of injury, you know, this is the place to do it. You know, there are many injuries that come out of war. One of the most devastating injuries is the traumatic brain injury. And a lot of those people, you can't tell they've been injured. And that's very hard on them because, you know, everybody expects them to be normal, you know, or be exactly as they were. And they're profoundly different. And that's a very, very difficult injury to treat that we're still learning a lot about. I would say I was lucky that I worked in the amputee section. That's a much easier injury to take care of.
Adele, early in your book, you tell a story about one of your peers getting a call from one of her patients who is on a ski trip. And I couldn't help but wonder if you're familiar with the National Ability Center that we have right here in Park City. And they do an awful lot of work with people, amputees, getting them out on sleds and on skis and on the slopes. And the story that you described quickly about the call from the ski vacation made me think that possibly that was from Park City.
Oh, it could very well have been from Park City. I mean, one of the most favorite activities that the patients got to do was to go on ski trips because they really felt like they were, you know, back out there doing sports again. They loved it. And we had many ski trips during the winter.
Huh.
That's very great. Very popular.
Right. And, yeah, like Tim says, they just do so much for veterans here. And it's becoming, they're doing more and more each year. Their veterans program at the National Ability Center has expanded terrifically. So who knows, maybe your next stop will be Park City in your career. We ride bikes here, too.
I wanted to go on one of those ski trips, but I never did because I don't know how to ski. And I thought, you know, I'm just going to be in the way. You know, all the patients are going to have to worry about, you know, me.
So, oh, good.
But I would love to see it.
Yeah. Very inspiring, actually. You know, in your book, you go through, of course, stories of different patients that you saw. So maybe you can tell us about Cosmo, your toughest patient, and how that sort of treating Cosmo changed both of your lives.
Oh, well, first I have to preface that because of patient privacy laws, you know, I had to really conceal my patients' identities. So
right.
The Cosmo that's in the hospital was a different Cosmo than the one who was an outpatient and also was a different patient than the one who begged to have his leg amputated at the end. But they were all, to me, a very same character because when you're a physical therapist, you see so many hundreds of patients over your career that you begin to recognize, you know, certain personality
traits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you're kind of like, oh, you know, I've worked with this person before, even though you haven't, but you recognize them right away. And so Cosmo was, to me, you know, an example of a difficult patient, someone who's, you know, he was going to do what he was going to do, and he sure wasn't going to do what I wanted him to do. You know, and that's, you know, that's a hard person to work with. It's also, you know, he would make me so angry. You know, I would get so frustrated, but at the same time, you know, I really wanted to help him. And then I would have these constant battles with him and then with me, and it was just like, I remember once the chaplain suggested that the two of us go into counseling together. I just thought that was like a ludicrous idea. I wanted to highlight, you know, because there's so many books out there that talk about, you know, patients, you know, triumphing and overcoming obstacles, and it's always a really feel-good thing. And we had many, many stories like that in our clinic, but we also had a lot of stories about, you know, patients who didn't do as well as they could have. And, you know, because they had to deal with where they were right then at that moment in time. And, you know, that was the kind of patient I wanted to highlight in the book.
Adele, You just said that Cosmo's life was changed, your life was changed, that you recognize these traits, these character traits in people, and you've had exposure to thousands of people. And I'm thinking and assuming that the way – I don't know how your life has changed. I guess that's my question. You state that your life has been changed by this experience. Who were you when you went over thinking you were going to have this cush job across the street that you were going to commute to in 3 minutes versus who you are now, having been dramatically changed? Are you more authentic, more fully expressed, more conscious? I mean, what happened during that period of time to you?
Well, I feel like I grew up. Now I was really kind of, an immature sort of party person when I first started working at Walter Reed. And now I found myself in a situation, that was very, very tough. I was kind of totally not prepared for it. And, I kept saying I was going to quit. It was too stressful. But I never did quit, and it was because I felt like I was part of something that was much bigger than myself. And, again, it was the first time I've ever been part of something much bigger than myself, and probably the last time, too. And, we were doing stuff that really mattered. And, in D.C., I feel like people are always kind of looking for the greener grass, and that also, everybody thinks they're very important over here. I don't know what it's like over there in Utah, but
we're all very humble here.
Yeah, that's good. Well, I just sort of felt like, that sort of spared me. Like, I couldn't get caught up in that sort of thing because I was sort of doing something that really mattered, even though no one really knew it. Before I worked at Walter Reed, I could pack and move in 30 minutes, and I was very proud of that. I owned almost no possessions. Now I moved a lot when I was a kid, and I think that kind of leaked over into my life. But I moved a lot. I changed jobs frequently. I never had a serious relationship. I avoided any kind of commitment. And then I found myself in my biggest life commitment, which was Walter Reed. And it became my anchor. And because Walter Reed anchored me in a way, I was able to settle down. I bought my own place. I bought a real bed. I embarked on a committed relationship, and we have a house together and two little boys. And I know that wouldn't have happened if I hadn't walked into something so above my head.
Well, and hearing you say that you did something bigger than yourself and you may never do that again, I mean, first thought is we can't predict the future. My second thought is you've had kids. That's huge. And my third thought is you also took this incredible story and put it into a book, and you're an author, and that's bigger than most people's selves also. How big a role do you think writing will be for you in the future?
Oh, well, I mean, I certainly hope that I can – that I have another book in me. I'm still sort of processing that I do have a book out.
Yeah.
Do you consider yourself an author, or do you consider yourself kind of a one-off because of this incredible, amazing, bigger-than-yourself experience that had to be committed to paper?
I feel like I had to write it. I always wanted to write a book, and I always felt like maybe I would write this, when I was older. But my partner was the one who really pushed me to write it now. She felt it was very important. I see myself as a physical therapist. I hope I get the opportunity to write another book, but I feel like I was very lucky.
It's interesting, Adele, in the reviews of your book, how people say over and over, there must be something different that you have done with this book in your writing. People read lots of books along this sort of genre, but there must be something new and different that you've done. So you obviously have a gift with your writing, and that leads me into, I think it was a blog I read by you, and we love it because we live in a big biking community, and it's about when your bike was stolen and then how you found it. Can you tell that story? It was such a great article, and my bike was just stolen in December, so I hope it happens to me too.
Oh, doesn't that just make you crazy?
Yes.
Yeah, I came out and my bike was gone. And I mean, I just totally lost it because, you know, I love my bike. And, you know, I had bought this special bike for myself. And when it was taken, I remember thinking, I wish I'd left my computer outside or I wish they took my car. But so then I devoted myself for like 8 months to trying to find my bike. You know, I was constantly going to pawn shops, and I was always looking at people who were riding a bike to see if they had my bike. Remember a few times I was ready to run someone off the road because I thought they were riding my stolen bike. So, I was just completely obsessed with it. And then, you know, a few weeks ago I was at this bar downtown, and it was kind of, you know, kind of like a D.C. bar. Everybody was very important, very fancy, and I had too much to drink, and I come out of the bar, and there is my bike, and it's like right there, locked to a parking meter, and it's not to the left of the bar or to the right, but like right in front of the door, and I just completely lost it when I saw it. I went berserk, and, you know, my girlfriend was with me, and she was trying to calm me down because she thought I shouldn't be out there making a complete scene, and of course I was making a scene. And luckily, there was a bike store nearby. I ran over to the bike store, and I told them I needed the biggest, strongest lock they had. And they gave me this lock, and I ran over, and I locked my bike up. So there was whoever's bike it was. They had their lock on it, and now I had my lock on it. And then I called the cops, and the cops came. Three police cars came, and they had their lights on, and it was a big scene, and everybody came out of the bar, and I was freaking out. I said, whoever's bike it was, they better get on out here. And he came out, and then he was all mad at me because I had locked it up, and he wanted me to take the lock off. And then he was accusing me of stealing his bike.
Completely indignant.
And the whole reason, you know, my book agency has this annual happy hour every year, and so this was their annual happy hour, and I was out there, like, ruining it for everybody because I was out on the street having a fit about this bicycle. So, but it turned out I had saved a copy of the police report on my phone. I had taken a picture of it. So I pull out my police report, you know, while he's accusing me of trying to steal his bike, and I like to read out the serial numbers. So that was it.
That was
he, like,
it.
Unlocked the bike.
Well, did he actually steal the bike, or had he acquired it from someone and was actually an innocent third party?
Well, he said that he had gotten it from a friend who moved to New York. But then the cops decided they needed to take the bike into the station, and I needed to come by in the morning and get it. So when I went in the next day to get the bike, I saw the new police report, and they had written this guy's name and number down and his address as finder. And so, like, I memorized his phone number. When I got home, I gave him a phone call because I wanted to find out, you know. Plus, I was mad at him. But he said, he gave me some lame story that he got it at this Home Depot where, you know, someone just handed him a free bicycle.
Yeah.
I got to believe that with your experience at Walter Reed and all the people that you've interacted with, you were able to read that guy pretty well also. You've probably encountered a few of those along the way.
Well, sure. And, you know, I'm not the easiest personality myself, so I'm sure he told me he was going to change his phone number.
And did you say, yeah, you probably better, because I'm going to keep calling you?
He said that he might need to get a new phone. I said he should go to Home Depot. I said maybe someone will just hand him a free phone.
Oh, that's a really good story. Well, congratulations on getting your bike back. And also congratulations on this new book. It's Run, Don't Walk, The Curious and Chaotic Life of a Physical Therapist Inside Walter Reed Army Medical Center. And Adele Levine, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for interviewing me.
All right. Take care. Best of luck.
You too. Goodbye. All right.
Again, Adele Levine with Run, Don't Walk. We'll be right back.
The ABC4 Weather Report comes to you live Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. after the NPR News. Brought to you by Albion Financial Group.
Thanks for listening to The Mountain Life. Want to thank our underwriters.
Park City Clinic, Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Prudential Utah Real Estate, San Francisco Design, Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, Grand Valley Bank, Park Meadows Country Club.
And tune in to Cool Science Radio tomorrow. Tim's going to join me as guest host. We'll talk to Simon Head. The book Mindless, Why Smarter Machines Are Making Dumber Humans. You're listening to KPCW Park City.